Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Cases on Hold. We're on episode number 78 for March 19th drop here. So we appreciate you coming on board here. I'm Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor of Methods.
So we appreciate you coming here. These opinions are our own and our own alone. They don't belong to the JBJS Editorial Board or anyone else affiliated with JBJS. And this is brought to you by, surprise, JBJS. The CME that you can get from JBJS is unparalleled. A lot of different options, a lot of different learning options, and you can go online, jbjs.org, and really get their learn on. So go forward to it, and this is brought to you by JBJS CME. Without further ado, we're going to go from the top of the pile, Think JBJS, by our editor-in-chief, Mo Bhandari. It's permanently free. If you want to learn what's new in hand and wrist surgery, read an article by Wagner. It's also permanently free. Two-stage exchange arthroplasty, the expiration date is approaching, by Parvizi, and there's two times commentary on it because that is a controversial area and topic of thinking when it comes to treating.
That's a first where we've have not one, but two comments on like an opinion piece kind of.
It is a very controversial piece is what I can say is when it comes to what's ending and what's continuing. You know, it's saying that this procedure will no longer be done. So interesting to give a prophetic viewpoint on a procedure that has been done for obviously decades and decades. What's important? Community health worker interventions in orthopedic surgery by Hyde et al. It's permanently free. And it's also one of those interesting topics that really does make a difference in helping our patients. The Temple of Healing by Fareed. It's also permanently free. Trends in Medicare payment for facility fees and surgeon professional fees for spine surgeries by Federico. Orthopedic Surgery in the Jehovah's Witness Patients, Clinical, Ethical, and Legal Considerations by Stone. Very good for your patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses and how to treat them. Shared decision-making in total hip and knee arthroplasty, understanding surgeon and patient perspective regarding when it's time for surgery by Cole. Dysfunctions of the windlass mechanism associated with hallucis rigidus, a case control study by Ihara et al. And finally, we've got a bunch of these articles here. So you got a lot to read here. Developing linkages between PROMIS physical function CAT and quick dash scores in hand surgery, a crosswalk study by Darouche. And then early MRI can predict the indication for surgery in brachial plexus birth injury, results of the nap time study by Bauer et al. So lots of things to look at there in all different areas and realms of orthopedics. But now we're going to switch to our headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld is going to talk about improved risk adjustment for comorbid diagnosis and administrative claims analyses of orthopedic surgery by Kotosovit et al.
Yes. So this was an interesting study. You know, as I was working through it and reading it, I thought about a lot of different things. If we are just going to go with their setup, their premise in their narrative, the setup at the end of the introduction says, researchers in other clinical disciplines have developed methods to improve the capture of patient comorbidities with a particular focus on the choice of comorbidity measure, duration of look back, and inclusion of additional sources beyond inpatient admissions. The goal of this study was to apply the best practices derived from other disciplines to an orthopedic population to quantify improvements in capture rates and in model fit and discriminatory power. So, you know, my initial take was like, oh, this is a study for researchers. This doesn't really have like a direct clinical corollary. So it's kind of like when we're working with a data set, say Medicare data, you have one option. We talked last episode about which comorbidity measure to use. And I made a statement at that time basically saying like, you know, there are several out there that are validated and justified. It's more important that you're using one than which one you're particularly using. So let's just say you went with Charlson comorbidity. You can develop that comorbidity score just based off of what was coded associated with the event or you can be more exhaustive and have a look back period of a year or longer and actually, you know, build a more comprehensive and likely more exhaustive assessment of the conditions that the patient is dealing with. More data is always better. That's like the dirty little secret in research, is that the more information you have, however you're obtaining it, the better it is. From a clinical standpoint, I feel like if you have the patient in front of you and you're admitting them in the ER with like a hip fracture, you can obviously speak to the patient. You can speak to their family members. You can look in their medical record, presuming that you have, you know, something like Epic that links with other hospitals, or they're a patient in your system, and you can see what their medical comorbidities are, right? So this is not really, the way it's constructed is not really a question for clinical care, I don't feel, although some of the touchstones and the messaging is also valid. If I ask patient X, who's an 85-year-old woman with a hip fracture, what are your other medical problems? She may not be able to tell me. She may not recall all of them. She may have trouble describing certain ones. And if I just want, you know, if she just says, oh, it's high blood pressure, and she left out that she had a heart attack 3 years ago, then obviously what I'm writing in her admission medical record is not correct. But if I went back and I looked in her medical records and I see that, oh yeah, she had a heart attack 3 years ago, and then I include that, then it'll be more complete. So my initial take was like, this is really about people who are working with big data registries, things like that. And that's, you know, a lot of what they're talking about, other researchers in other disciplines, I feel like that's essentially what they were getting at too. But their conclusion is that this can improve risk adjustment in orthopedic clinical or health services research and quality improvement and payment models. So I feel like they are trying to make a recommendation sort of, you know, for the US News and World Report determinations about mortality rates for predicted versus observed, or even if there's going to be penalties for treatment of patients that come from certain payers, you'd hope that they would be factoring these kinds of things in. Certainly, if you're talking about the payers, they have access to their own, you know, patient data. But if they're just going off of what's reported, again, the tautology applies, more is better. So then we get into the second layer, which is, how do you ultimately define this? And what are you looking for? And how frequently must the condition be present to qualify? So if you're just looking back 1 year, or you're looking back 3 years, or you're looking back 10 years, and then if it's something that they have, you know, one encounter for, or there are four or five encounters for it, or just do two encounters suffice? It's an interesting premise, because ultimately they looked at Medicare data, they looked at New York State healthcare cost and utilization data, and they looked at market scan data. So they describe it as Medicare, obviously being Medicare, the New York one being an all-payer data set, and the market scan being a private payer data set. But like, the data that they're capturing should, you know, be the same. Like, you don't fill something out for Medicare patients differently than you do for United Healthcare patients, or you don't say like, oh, this is a Blue Cross patient, so I'm only gonna put like whatever comorbidities come to mind. Oh, it's a Medicare patient, I'm gonna document all of the comorbidities. I don't think things really work that way. I guess in some respects, you know, because Medicare has built in ways for patients to, you know, they have their annual Medicare that they really do try to make sure patients are getting to that. And in some circumstances, I think it really applies to all payers, but there may be efforts at the hospital level to really get a very accurate determination regarding medical comorbidities that may impact risk. So maybe that changes in some respects, but I think this is a little bit of a, like, there's some window dressing going on here. They're like, oh, we're looking at it in Medicare, and we're looking at it in this one, and we're looking at it in this one. And they did find that there were differences, that the index admission missed anywhere from 9 to 66% of the Ehlers-Hauser comorbidities for Medicare, and then between 3 and 39% in the all-payer cohort, and 14 to 58% for the private payer cohort. But all of those overlap, of course. And it was basically, you know, differences from the index admission as including, you know, adding in from the previous year. So again, more data is always going to be better. There's still no gold standard comparison. You don't know what the epistemological truth is about how many conditions this patient had. You're just showing what the percent difference is. So there is some issue here as far as the counterfactual goes. I think it's an interesting idea and you know, certainly advantageous if their stance is, you know, third-party payers and quality measures really need to do a better job of establishing the full panoply of risk. But I feel like those organizations are just going to put it back on the providers and they're like, you got to report it. And then it just boils down to going back to, you know, how are you finding these things at the point of care?
I thought variety was the spice of life. So the more, the better, right? Just kidding.
Yeah, more information is always better. Like if you go back 10 years, you're going to have more information that relative to the 1 year. If you go back 1 year, you're going to have more information relative to the just the index admission.
Makes sense. Well, the next one is going to be a little bit different. We're going to switch from comorbid diagnoses to basic science, looking at enhanced antibiotic release and mechanical strength in ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene antibiotic blends, the role of submicron gentamicin sulfate particles. By Asik et al., there's an infographic on this. So the prevention and treatment of infection is still an entity without a single solution. With regards to prevention, we've been using antibiotic powders within the wound, which, to the chagrin of our ID colleagues, they don't love it. Or we use antibiotic cement to reduce the likelihood of developing infection. But the elution characteristics of both of these options are typically short-acting. With regards to treating infection, having a conduit for eluting antibiotics in the implants could actually be beneficial for patients with regards to antibiotic elution and mechanical property strength. This has been done and sometimes with a coating or an antimicrobial coating on the outside or antibiotic coating on outside of an implant, but that really hasn't taken off. This group, it's the MGH Harris Lab, has proposed polyethylene as a conduit for all treatment regimens, and potentially you could use it for prevention. You could also use it in DARE, one-stage and two-stage exchange arthroplasty. So these researchers investigated the enhancement of mechanical properties and antibiotic release in ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene through the encapsulation of submicron gentamicin sulfate particles by embedding the submicron gentamicin sulfate particles into flakes of polyethylene at concentrations of 2% to 10% by weight, and looked at mechanical properties, elution characteristics, and morphological attributes. The hypothesis was that decreasing antibiotic particle size encapsulated in this polyethylene will lead to increased or enhanced mechanical strength. These gentamicin sulfate particles were prepared and blended with these polyethylene flakes using a dual asymmetric centrifuge mixer, and the blends were consolidated. And they compared the one at the submicron level to medium levels, which came as received, and large, which are resolidified gentamicin sulfate particles. And the morphology of the test samples were tested using digital light microscopy, scanning electron microscopy, and focused ion beam scanning electron microscopy. They also looked at mechanical properties. They did something called tensile and IZOD impact testing. And wear rates were measured using a multi-directional orthopedic pin-on disc wear tester, which they did it against cobalt chromium, which is a sort of typical metal that's used when it's using the wear characteristics. Gentamicin sulfate elution from the test samples and the gentamicin-containing bone cement were tested in water at body temperature. So they did have a baseline of looking at bone cement as the elution there. And antimicrobial activity testing was conducted on the test samples using nuclear magnetic resonance analysis to ensure that the eluted gentamicin had no detectable chemical changes compared to control gentamicin. So what did the authors find? They found that these polyethylene samples with submicron gentamicin particles showed distribution among the contours of the polyethylene flakes inside the fusion lines, meaning it kind of integrated more than the other particles. And these polyethylene samples with submicron gentamicin particles also exhibited superior mechanical properties, including higher ultimate tensile strength, elongation at break, and better yield strength compared with samples with larger particles. The wear rates of these submicron gentamicin polyethylene blends when articulating against polished cobalt chromium disc remained unchanged compared with virgin polyethylene. Now, they did antimicrobial testing against Staph aureus, and this was similar in all groups. The 10% submicron gentamicin blend, gentamicin polyethylene blend, demonstrated a markedly higher and more sustained antibiotic release rate compared with the resolidified and the as-received or medium gentamicin polyethylene blends with the same gentamicin loading. And they did that nuclear magnetic resonance analysis of the eluted gentamicin, and there was no significant shifts in the observed peaks compared to those of the control gentamicin. So it was still eluting the same gentamicin as seen before. And so this is an interesting in vitro, not an in vivo, but an in vitro testing of taking submicron particles of gentamicin and being able to basically tether it or work it into ultra-high weight molecular polyethylene and being able to have it elute out the antibiotic without causing any mechanical property changes, in fact, making it stronger than the as-is or bigger particles of it. So this is really interesting because it's showing a viability, and they call this a honeycomb percolation model for encapsulating gentamicin into this ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene. The cool part about it is that you can do this in other drugs besides gentamicin. So this might be a nice drug delivery device besides gentamicin that can be used in the primary setting or use any setting where there's polyethylene being placed in there. So it could become a new drug delivery device. Obviously, it's very useful potentially in the treatment of infection, especially as we do more one-stage infection or one-stage exchange arthroplasty, given that Dr. Parvizi said that the two-stage exchange arthroplasty is ending in an expiration date. So options here to hopefully treat patients and provide longer-lasting elution characteristics obviously needs to be seen in an in vivo setting to see if this bears out or not.
Yeah, I feel like really exciting stuff and potentially very game-changing. There's a lot that has to happen between this, the publication of this, and ultimately application in clinical practice. But really, some, you know, if it does bear out to what is sort of insinuated here, I think very powerful for reducing the risk of infection in the primary setting, and then certainly as a means to treat those infections that develop subsequently.
Now we're going to switch gears to something very different, but in the total general world. So hopefully it's something we can see further down the road, encourage people who are doing this great research to keep sending this in. It's really interesting information, and the orthopedic community would love to learn about it. I know I did when I was reading it. So we're doing the Your Cases on Hold featurette, testing the feasibility of a cross-setting measure to address the rising trend in hospital outpatient total joint arthroplasty procedures by Wallace et al. It's free for 30 days. So this really is a study looking at quality measures for total joint arthroplasty. And typically, the quality measures for total joint arthroplasties were measured in the inpatient setting because total hips and total knees were on the inpatient-only list until 2018. Once they came off the list, more and more total joint arthroplasties are being performed in the outpatient setting. And legacy CMS elective primary total joint complication measures, which is defined as the hospital-level risk standardized complication rate, also known as the RSCR, following elective primary total hip and total knee arthroplasty, captured only total joint arthroplasty performed in the inpatient setting. So this study sought to develop a reliable, valid, cross-setting measure of total joint arthroplasty complication outcomes by respecifying the legacy 90-day hospital-level total hip, total knee complication measure to include procedures performed in hospital outpatient settings so that the hospital-level risk standardized measure of complication could include patients undergoing total joint arthroplasties in either an inpatient or outpatient hospital setting. The authors used the Medicare Administrative Database, Claims Database, and enrollment information for 989,000 patients, 587 patients, who underwent total joint arthroplasty from April 1st, 2018 to March 31st, 2021. 67% of these were performed in the inpatient setting, while 33% were performed in the outpatient setting. And this population included 2,747 hospitals who did at least 25 total joint arthroplasties. Not surprisingly, because these were Medicare patients, they were the beneficiaries that had to be equal to or greater than 65 years of age undergoing a qualifying elective primary total joint arthroplasty. And they looked at Medicare inpatient, outpatient, and physician and professional claims, including the fee for service and outpatient service data and physician claims for the 12 months prior to and 3 months after an index encounter was used. or was performed. The hospital level measure reported a risk standardized complication rate within 90 days after the index procedure or the 3-month follow-up period. The composite complication outcome was dichotomous, either yes for any complication or no for any complications. Now, the difference of this model is the complications that were included. So typically, they would just include complications that happened during the index surgery or during readmission. But given that we wanted to expand to the outpatient setting here, they included those that occurred during observation stays, emergency department visits, or ambulatory surgery center encounters to create a comprehensive model of where the complications could come from. They even included a technical expert panel and advisory group with representatives from relevant orthopedic professionals that provided advice on key measure decisions. And they did use the same risk variables as in the legacy measures. The authors developed 3 different models. And the first model was a single risk model with regression coefficients estimated from the combined cohort of inpatient and outpatient procedures. The second one had 2 distinct models, one for each setting, meaning they had one for the inpatient setting and one for the outpatient setting. The winning model was using a single combined model, but with an added indicator variable reflecting an inpatient or outpatient setting. This last model had the highest discrimination and was the best model for quality evaluation purposes. So the overall median unadjusted hospital level complication rate was 2.94%, and the median risk standardized complication rate was 2.85%. Patients had a 33% increase in the odds of a complication at a higher risk or lower quality hospital compared with the lower risk or higher quality hospital, which suggests that hospital quality does influence hospital level risk standardized complication rates. That was an odds ratio of 1.33. The analysis showed a median reliability score of 0.85 with a threshold of 0.6, so this is above the threshold amount. In the assessment of measure score validity, the patients found a weak correlation between the lower risk standardized complication rates and higher overall hospital star rating summary scores, especially at the extremes. And similarly, the authors found a weak correlation between high hospital total joint volume and lower or better risk standardized complication rates. So you had higher volume, you had better hospital star summary ratings, and if you had higher quality, then you'd have lower risk of complications. So this is something that's a little bit more esoteric for those who are not using all the claims database, but it does help provide a measure, but it's a first hospital quality measure for federal programs that includes both inpatient and outpatient procedures. And they used a single combined model with an added indicator of inpatient versus outpatient setting. And this could possibly be used, hopefully, in a risk adjustment model, especially as we look at complications and risks in light of different bundled payments models that we have, and it can be used to assess total joint hospitals in the future. Any thoughts?
So, I mean, everything that you said, definitely stands. Interesting study, definitely, academic in the sense of that some of these discussions are more around measurement than they are necessarily in the realm of direct clinical care. While they did find that their combined model had a C statistic of 0.66, and that was the best of performing of the 3, it still isn't really all that great. That's probably one of the biggest concerns.
It's not a huge take home from there. So at least a model to start with, but maybe not enough to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, that, when you start getting into, well, this should be used for risk adjustment and this should be used for X, Y, and Z, your discrimination isn't that high. And that may indicate you're including too many things that are not necessarily complications, or you're not including enough things that are complications, especially when, it's primarily based on not the actual event, but on what's reported.
Agreed. Keeps it interesting. All right.
Yeah.
Going to our honorable mentions. We've got 3 of them for you here. So outcomes of total ankle replacement versus ankle arthrodesis for the treatment of end-stage ankle arthritis. A concise follow-up at a minimum of 10 years of a previous report. So it's always nice to be able to go long-term and look at this. This is by Glazebook et al. With a commentary. There's a visual summary and it's free for 30 days. So there's no reason to not check it out. This study compared total ankle replacements versus ankle arthrodesis for the treatment of end-stage ankle arthritis with a minimum follow-up of 10 years range of 10 to 18 years and a mean follow-up of 13.2 years. Patients in the ankle arthrodesis group had a greater chance of having no further surgery following their index procedure compared to those in the total ankle replacement group. The total ankle replacement group and ankle arthrodesis groups demonstrated similar functional outcomes. And the long-term clinical outcomes, the total ankle replacement and ankle arthrodesis were similar, a diverse cohort in which the treatment was tailored to the condition of the patient. The next one is long-term results of 331 two-stage exchanges for PJI following total hip arthroplasty, low reinfection, and mechanical failure rates at 10 years. So also another 10-year study by Terhune et al. For 30 days free. This is from our colleagues in Mayo, looking at a series of 331 two-stage exchange arthroplasties that were performed for the treatment of infection. And there was a low rate of aseptic revision, 8%, and a low rate of reinfection at 11% at 10 years. These long-term mechanical and infection data must be kept in mind when considering a paradigm shift to one-stage exchanges, which is in contradictory commentary to the article by Dr. Parvizi. And finally, long-term results of the Birmingham Hip Resurfacing Implant in the United States, an updated analysis of a single institution's experience by Zook et al. And it's permanently free. The authors previously reported the 5-year results of the Birmingham Hip Resurfacing Implant. And this study evaluated a total of 224 patients with contemporary indications, including 179 patients from the original study. Survivorship free from any revision was 96%, and survivorship free from aseptic revision was 97.4% at 15 years, respectively. The mean serum cobalt and chromium levels were 1.4 and 1.5 parts per billion, respectively, low given the fact that it does have known ability to shed metal. The patient-reported outcomes for the Birmingham's hip resurfacing were similar to those of a total hip arthroplasty cohort, and equal proportions of patients remained active. However, those patients in the Birmingham hip resurfacing group trended towards more remaining highly active. There you have it, another episode of Your Case is on Hold, and we thank you for joining us.